A red letter N unfolds into a spectrum of colors.
The following film contains descriptions of sexual abuse involving minors, which may be disturbing for some viewers. Dawn breaks over a forest shrouded in mist. Young people move between green tents amongst the trees. An adult leads a troop of boys on a hike, archive footage of a huge scouts assembly.
The values of the Boy Scouts of America were taking young men and giving them a role in life. It was different. It was a guiding tool.
It resembles a music festival.
I thought Scouts was a great thing. I really did. It was Norman Rockwell. It was Mom, Pop, and Apple Pie. Memorial Day parades, and the Scout troops would be holding the flag. It was America and patriotism.
Holding an American flag, a scout salutes.
To be a Boy Scout meant something. It grew into the biggest youth club in America, and maybe the most famous youth club in the world.
Archive footage of scouts meeting American presidents.
Your scout law commands you to be trustworthy, loyal, helpful, friendly, courteous, kind, obedient, cheerful, thrifty, brave, clean, and reverent.
A photo of a young black scout shaking President Obama's hand. Another of President Trump speaking at a scout rally.
Pitching tents, making fires, cooking things on an open fire, and just sitting around telling stories.
Learning how to fend for yourself, learning to cook, learning to set up a camp, learning to identify plants and poison ivy especially. You go to summer camp and you learn to shoot a rifle and you learn archery and you learn how to build a rope bridge and you learn life-saving first aid.
Boy Scouts for me just represented the best of America.
Scouts march in a parade.
But the Boy Scouts had this dirty little secret. It was all just veneer to mask what was a very dangerous organization.
A scene being sewn on a scout uniform, a Netflix documentary film, a scout badge is woven.
Today, the Boy Scouts of America, one of the biggest youth organizations in the country, filed for bankruptcy protection. The scouts face an onslaught of lawsuits from men who claimed they were sexually abused, sometimes going back decades, by scoutmasters and other leaders.
More than 82,000 alleged victims span generations.
Red dots across a U.S. map.
People need to understand what happened, what took place.
A day of reckoning for the Boy Scouts of America.
An American institution in turmoil. The Boy Scouts of America filing for bankruptcy.
This is history's largest case of child sexual abuse connected to one organization. Larger than any other youth-serving organization, larger than the Catholic Church, larger than the Southern Baptist Church.
They want to know what happened. They want the truth to come out, and they want to know who knew what, when did they know it, and how did this happen to them.
They don't want to face the evil that lurks within. There's like cancer in the Boy Scouts.
This is something I held on as a secret, even after everything. Something I never told anybody, not even my own children. I got a text message from one of my children today that said, "Just want to let you know I'm very proud of what you're doing. I know it's not easy. But I'm proud of you."
This is a human rights movement we're talking about today, a civil rights movement for children against one of the biggest offenders in the world, the Boy Scouts of America.
The headline, a flood of abuse claims.
I don't care if I bring the whole temple down on everybody's heads. I will not stand for this. This is an abomination.
The idyllic image of the forest is obscured, then obliterated by a growing mass of condemning headlines. Directed by Brian Knappenberger. The title appears, crisscrossed with strands of red thread. Scouts Honor, the secret files of the Boy Scouts of America. The Plano Police Department in Texas. Michael Johnson, Youth Protection Officer, Boy Scouts of America 2010 to 2020.
I'm Detective Mike, former detective of the City of Plano Police Department. I became a detective and I got on the SWAT team about the same time in 86. Always investigated crimes against children.
Hello.
Hi.
So a child and family friendly room like this is where any police detective or an advocate for a victim, child or teen, that has experienced any type of abuse, sexual abuse, this is where we sit and talk to them, interview them. This is huge, this whole area for all police departments. That commitment to the, you know, that victim sensitive, trauma-informed care that we provide to families and victims after they've experienced what for many of them is arguably the worst experiences of their life.
For 16 years, I did nothing but investigate child sexual abuse. So I've interviewed a lot of kids, varying ages, and interrogated a lot of perpetrators, talked to a lot of parents, been to a lot of crime scenes, as well as work on some things federally and nationally with two different administrations.
Before we get into what happened later, I mean, just start with when you were first hired by the Boy Scouts. You were the Youth Protection Director at National Headquarters. Why did you decide to take the job?
So I will, you know, I always ask people when I get asked that, do you want the truth or what I was told to say? I mean, just, you know, so I'm going to tell you the truth, all right?
I actually want to know both.
You want to? Okay. I want to tell you the truth. How's that? I can do the truth. When I started in 2010 as Youth Protection Director for the Boy Scouts of America, I was excited. I was pumped. I was a little anxious because, you know, what is it? This was the first position like this for any major youth serving organization or any youth serving organization ever, especially somebody with my background and skill sets. I thought I was going to work to keep kids safe in a major institution. The Boy Scouts are at the national level and even at the council level all about the brand. It's a beautiful brand. Boy Scouts of America conjures up parades, apple pie, American flag, you know, all that. And they don't like anything too negative that's associated with the brand. So I come in and I say, okay, we're a high-risk organization, just as a general discussion point, because it is. What can we do to keep kids safe, given that we're a high-risk organization? You're a youth-serving organization. You're the Boy Scouts of America youth-serving organization, all right? You have no choice. You have to be beyond reproach on something as very basic as that.
What were they telling you to say?
Oh, that Boy Scouts of America is safe. That Boy Scouts of America is the gold standard. The Boy Scouts of America has a rigorous application and screening process. That the Boy Scouts of America conducts criminal background checks of all of its leaders. You know, that the youth protection program is better and by far than any other youth servant organization program.
They wanted you to project their image of
market
safety.
Market this image of safety.
That's which, not what you were seeing, though.
That's totally not what I'm seeing. I became aware that they weren't telling me everything. They were withholding information.
At his suburban home, journalist and Scouts Honor author Patrick Boyle searches through boxes of files and documents.
I kind of stumbled onto the story just out of pure curiosity as a reporter. I had read a news brief in the New York Times back in the 80s about one scout leader being convicted of abusing scouts. And I clipped the brief out and put it in my ideas file that every reporter has. And I forgot about it. Then years later, I was working in Washington and read in my own newspaper about a lawsuit in Virginia in which a boy who had been molested by a scout leader had sued the scouts. And as a part of that lawsuit, the Boy Scouts had to turn over to the lawyer for the boy confidential files about people who had been kicked out of scouting for alleged child molestation.
A BSA registration document from the 80s.
And I said, wow.
The applicant pled guilty to sex charges.
I went over to Virginia naively with one legal pad in my hand to look at the files, figured I'd spend a few hours there. And I began reading them and taking notes, and I quickly realized there's a lot more information here than I even imagined. I was blown away by opening these files. Oh, this is from scouting in 1923. I've never seen this. So these are pages from Scouting magazine in the 1920s where the scouts have actually written about people kicked out from scouting. Red flag, there's a headline here, red flag this man. Red flag this man. warning.
Silent movie footage of a scout troop.
The confidential files, as they're known, really began back in England right at the beginning. Soon after the scouts were founded in England in 1908, the scouts there realized they had a problem because scouting has always attracted men who were attracted to the boys. And the struggle for the company has been to keep them out and keep it quiet. And these efforts started back in England when they had to kick out the doctor at the very first Boy Scout camp in the world.
Grainy footage of scouts camping in Gilwell Park in Essex, England.
In the United States, they created what they called the Red Flag List. There was a Time story in 1935 where they talked about the Red Flag List.
Red Flag List bars undesirables, Roosevelt says.
This Red Flag List in the United States eventually evolved into what they call the Ineligible Volunteer File. But in the scouts, they called it the Confidential Files. And for very good reason, because they intended to keep everything confidential. Some people ended up calling them perversion files.
Patrick looks through more files and documents.
During that time, we didn't know how many files there were. I had the 231 original files, plus I supplemented it with my own information. These files were so sensitive that the Boy Scouts did everything they could to make sure that they could not be seen by parents, by police, by prosecutors, even by other scout leaders. They had it under lock and key in National Headquarters. And they knew how sensitive this was.
A still of the BSA National Office, Irving, Texas.
The Boy Scouts knew that for this product to sell well, that they had to have the highest integrity among the Boy Scout leaders. So parents were convinced that when you put your boy in the hands of the Boy Scouts, you were handing them over to the most responsible men, the most honest men, the men of the highest integrity. So not only was your boy safe, but these men were great role models for your child. I have to suspect part of it was also strategic. They didn't want to open this up because if they started talking very bluntly about sex abuse and scouting, it might scare parents, it might scare sponsors, and they didn't need that because they were doing fine. The program was making money, they had lots of scouts.
Footage of a scout parade.
I was just stunned by the fact that I would talk to Boy Scout officials about my discoveries in the files, and I was giving them news. I knew things about abuse and scouting that nobody in scouting claimed to know. I knew what your numbers were. I knew what the patterns were. I knew where your vulnerabilities were. They were naive about sex abuse in general, but they had essentially a product defect that they were ignoring. And it was that this organization was built in a way that molesters could get in, abuse kids, and get away with it. When I first did the stories and said there were 400 cases, people told me I was making a big thing out of nothing. That really, there's not that many cases. I got a lot of angry letters from people saying, you're smearing the Boy Scouts of America over a problem that's really minuscule. People kept using that word.
Letters to Patrick calling him repulsive and pitiful.
How dare you accuse the Scouts of this? You're trying to ruin this organization. You really had to go out on a limb to make a public accusation against the Boy Scouts because you were accusing usually a respected community leader of what many people would consider the worst crime imaginable.
He opens his notepad.
But there is a truth there, and even if it's an inconvenient truth, I'm going to get at the truth. And I ended up being one of the ways that these files became public.
He flicks through handwritten notes and documents.
Every file was stunning, first because of the story that it tells. But collectively, they told a different kind of story.
An article and a redacted record date back to 1986.
I'll give you an example. It wasn't unusual for a leader to get into the Scouts after having been banned. Thomas Hacker was based primarily in Illinois.
The red dots on the U.S. map fade, highlighting one in Burbank, Illinois. Mark Eaton, a survivor of the 1988 Thomas Hacker trial, is a heavyset man with a trimmed gray beard.
Our troop, we did a lot of campouts. We did a lot of camping. At the time, it was just a nice guy that was taking an interest in me and wanted to get to know me. He became a leader and then ultimately became our scoutmaster of the troop. He was a deacon of the church. He was very much so a authoritarian figure in my life growing up. It took me until I was in my early 40s to realize I was a victim and I hadn't done something wrong. And somehow at 10, I should have known better.
He stifles a sob.
somehow about 11 or 12, I should have been able to see what this guy was doing. Somehow at 13 or 14, I should have said something. The touching, it was pretty much every camp out. There's, you know, 6 to 8 kids in there, and everybody's pants down. It was a tough conversation. I really didn't tell my parents much. I gave them enough of what they needed, but I didn't go into details. Just feeling like, dude, you...
He shakes his head, features crumpling, and presses his fingers to his brow.
You took my childhood. You took my growing up. I was so angry. I was never really good at controlling my temper and just being frustrated and punching holes in walls. Eagle Scout is the highest rank in Boy Scouts. It's a pretty big achievement, and it's just this big ceremony, at times solemn. You get dignitaries, state senators, or the local mayor come in and give a speech.
He's there watching this.
Mm-hmm. How do you take this award ceremony and then try to tie it together with this hidden in plain sight type of abuse that's going on? I want to take some of the stigma away from it, from boys being victims. I don't care what anybody says, there's still a very bad stigma about a boy being a victim of sexual abuse by another male. I want to take that stigma away because it's not the boy's fault.
The South Suburban Scoutmaster is in jail tonight on $500,000 bond, charged with sexually abusing 3 boys in his troop. Thomas Hacker faces 5 counts of aggravated criminal sexual assault. The boys were members of a scout troop at an Oak Lawn church. Hacker began working as a scoutmaster for the troop 8 years ago.
Headline, ex-scout leader gets 100 years, attorney Christopher Hurley.
Hacker was, in fact, in the IV files. When he was discovered at the time, he was the most prolific pedophile in the history of maybe of America or the world, honestly. He had molested hundreds of boys, and they knew that. And they knew he used their organization to do that.
He would abuse kids, get caught, say, I'll get help. Please don't charge me with a crime. I'll go away. And he'd go away. And he'd move to another town or move on to another youth group.
This was full sexual, oral, anal sexual abuse on dozens of occasions for many of them, and in group settings. The extent of notice that the scouting organization had as to his propensity to molest boys was off the charts.
A mugshot of Hacker.
I'd never taken the deposition of a serial pedophile, and I didn't know what to expect. My question to him is, why did you choose the Boy Scouts? And he said, because they made it so easy. They did nothing. They did nothing to put up barriers for him. And he knew it, and he used it.
A newspaper headline, agency scandal fears helped shield Hacker.
We represent 4,000 victims. The thing I've learned from now the bankruptcy and all the other clients I represent is that there are more hackers out there. There are more that have managed not to get caught. It takes incredible courage for guys to come forward, and I'm...
Hurley's lip quivers, and he looks away.
I'm proud of every single one of them. It's not easy. And, you know, you worry, you know, the burden I carry is, you know, is possibly disappointing them. So I don't want that.
Michael Johnson speaks over idyllic images of a camping trip.
Sexual abuse, those two words are kind of PG. It's easy to say. People are uncomfortable with sexual abuse. People don't want to visualize that these young men, and now men that are on this lawsuit, were having sex with men in their cars, in tents, at their house. I say these things, and I'm not trying to say them to incite you, but that's what sexual abuse is. We're talking about these men who have experienced or suffered X-rated activities as children in the scouting program, and who are they going to talk to about it? They're still grappling with their own internal experiences, demons, some of them, with what happened.
A man walks a dog along a beach at dusk.
My full name is Douglas Kennedy. I go by Doug.
Doug is a scout and a scout parent.
My father passed away from cancer when I was 13 months old. Never knew him. My mother never remarried. And this was back in the day when being a single parent wasn't as common as it was today. There were a lot of days where we didn't really know where the next meal was going to come from, but we were proud. Eventually, my mother in the summertime got me involved with the YMCA and working at a YMCA day camp. Around that same time, I was pretty active in the Boy Scouts. It was meaningful to me in my life, but the scouting movement as a whole, it was fun and I thought it had the right mission.
He flicks through an old magazine.
I'm quoted in Boy's Life, "Set the table for lunch. Hamburgers are ready in 3 minutes," Doug Kennedy shouted. And my picture's there.
He points to a photo of himself.
I can still see the window. There's a porch to the lodge. Bare light bulb light shines through. I go to sleep like it's any other night. And I woke up in the middle of the night, and the camp director had pulled the sleeping bag back. He had pulled my shorts down, and his head was down in my crotch, and his legs were up, wrapped around my head. And when I say wrapped around my head, he was naked, wrapped around my head, and I could not move. He was bigger than me, wiry, strong for his size. And I remember thinking, what's going on? Like, this is a joke or funny or something. And then I realize that he has me in his mouth. I'm trying to get his legs off from around my head, and I can't do it. It's always about power. It's a power dynamic. He has the power over me, and he knows it on so many levels. He's my employer. He's the person who's putting food on the table, the person my mother trusts. He's the person that everybody else is going to believe. If I had said anything, the solution would have been I would have been sent home. You disassociate. It's almost like you're looking at yourself. It's part of a mechanism to say, something bad is happening to you, but let's get our heads somewhere else. You're separating from the physical part of this.
His face crumples.
But what happened to me just took something away.
He shrugs helplessly with a bitter smile as he wipes away tears.
It felt like forever. It's a moment in time that's burned into my head.
Christopher Haywood, Boy Scout, 1993 to 2004.
Christopher Haywood grew up on the south side of Chicago. My abuse lasted 9 years. It would continue till I was 18. Being told by him no one would believe you, you're a kid, and what I would say people would believe, they wouldn't believe you. So that type of thing has stuck in my mind. So even him making threats, you know, of hurting somebody close to me, it could be my mother, my sisters, going to the point where he said killing. Just hearing that as a child, it messes with your psyche. I just felt at the time just not to say nothing, just to make sure everybody was all right.
In my case, he was an older scout that had been bullying people. I tried to say, can you leave?
I don't want to be here. And that's when he pulled out the knife. I tried to push past him once. He pressed the knife right here, barely pierced the skin, but that was enough. I knew I was powerless.
Tom Crummins.
As he was assaulting me. He kept saying, you're nothing, and you're never gonna be nothing. That shame became mine, and it's still there. And when something goes wrong, it confirms in my mind what I have always known to be true. I am nothing, and I'm never gonna be nothing. That's what the assault did.
Tom's whole family are scouts.
My abuse happened about 200 yards away from my mother, my father, and hundreds, if not thousands, of scouts and parents. It was that close. The weight of it was too high. I couldn't handle it.
He fidgets, upset.
Senior year of college, I'd climbed to the top of one of the research buildings on campus. It was a place I snuck up to a lot, and it was kind of, it had a great view of the city. And while I was up there, I wanted to jump. I tried to convince myself to do it, and I just couldn't get that, I think that strength, honestly, to do what I needed. And so I looked at my watch, which this is what I had on, and it read 12:32, and I tried to trick myself into doing it. I said, okay, well, when this hits 12:33, I'm just going to do it. It's not going to be my choice. It's just snap. That's the moment. And I took off the watch and was trying to work up the courage and, you know, banged my hand against the wall and was trying to, I don't know, find a way to do the thing I was too afraid to do. And in the act of that, I broke the watch. And it never got to 12:33.
He studies the broken watch, which he keeps in a black display case. Michael Johnson looks at an old photo of himself as a scout.
Interesting story about that picture of me as a Cub Scout. My mother died, and my father had already passed away, and we had to pack everything up and put it in the storage to get rid of the, you know, sell their house. Years later, within a month of me going to work for the Boy Scouts of America, I went to the storage room, knew the quilts would be in this big cedar cabinet, opened it up, pulled one of the quilts out, and literally being protected by the quilt, whoever put it in there, put it between, was that picture, which I had never seen before. So I felt like it was, kind of a thing, that this was something that was destined to be, destined to happen. I thought when I started with Boy Scouts that I was going to get support, and Mike, here's what you need to know. Boom, here's the stuff. You need to start going through this. This is our history, and this is what we do and why we do it and all that. Desk was clear, nothing. So I literally went to my then boss, VP level, Jim Terry, and I said, is there any standard of care type documents? He says, no, no, Mike, I'm not aware. So I reached out to a colleague of mine at the Center for Disease Control. She works in the Division of Violence Prevention. I said, hey, is there a standard of care document for youth serving organizations? She said, oh yeah, Mike, Boy Scouts participated in it. I'm like, what? So she sends me the document I just referred to. So as soon as I get it, I start reading through it. I get to the back, the participant list, and it literally, I think the second or third name on there is James Terry, Boy Scouts of America. So I take
this is exactly what he's telling you they don't have.
Never heard of it. Like, it doesn't, you know. So I take that book, literally it's a book. I take it to his office. I'm like, Jim, would you explain this to me? And he basically tells me, well, I really didn't participate in it. It was a man by the name of Doug Smith. They just put my name on it. I'm like, but did you know it existed? He says, yeah, I knew it existed. Well, who is Doug Smith? He was a national staff person at the national headquarters of Boy Scouts of America there in Irvine who got arrested in a child porn sting. I'm like, excuse me? What?
We prepared materials to help local councils and local units provide safe programs for children.
What were the circumstances under which you ceased working for the BSA?
I submitted my letter of retirement after the police had come to my house.
Federal child porn sting. Went to prison. Here I am, I'm the new youth protection director. They never told me about this guy.
Footage of the BSA headquarters.
They were withholding information. I go, well, wait a minute. Then how am I going to protect kids in the organization if I don't have access to the information about kids in the organization? So I guess that's an organizational decision that they made. Well, to me, to help me figure out what the policies, procedures, the content needs to be, I need that information. My frustrations in scouting, I'm going into these meetings sometimes, or sometimes I'm literally going to the general counsel because I'm reporting to him.
Stephen McGowan, BSA General Counsel from 2003 to 2022, is a plump, bald, bespectacled man in late middle age. Wearing a navy blue suit, he swigs from a bottle of water as he sits for his interview.
I was General Counsel of the Boy Scouts of America. Both youth protection and membership standards came under me until some point during the bankruptcy, at which point we moved it over. I came in as a kid. Went through all scouting. I'm an Eagle Scout. When my son came of age, became a scout leader and was a leader in a unit. I would tell you that we're a microcosm of our entire society. If we had a problem, our society had a problem. Many other institutions had the problem. We just happen to be the one with the deep pocket right now and the one that's willing to make the social commitment to try to make it right and to try to apologize, to try to do everything we can to keep kids safe, to try to compensate for these victims, but then to continue the mission. And many of the survivors are very clear. They want scouting to continue because of the good it did. We want to continue to do that.
Michael Johnston was a former youth protection director of the Boy Scouts of America. He said that the organization is still not safe for boys or girls. How do you respond to that?
Shocked. Personally, very, very disappointed. He never expressed that sentiment. He approved, and on a number of occasions while he worked for the Boy Scouts, championed our program and how effective our safe youth safety programs were. He and I worked very closely together on developing many of our new current modern youth protections, and we did not have many disagreements. I remember him saying that he felt that I supported the reforms that he was suggesting more than he felt anyone had done before.
He tells a different story. He basically says that he's frustrated trying to put some of these youth protection programs in place, and then he's getting resistance.
All I can tell you is I was shocked.
I don't know how else to put it. He's lying. I could put it, I guess there's a softer term, being deceptive, not telling the truth, whatever term is comfortable, for people. The fact is, especially in the last 3 or 4 years, he and I were constantly battling, contentious on each various item that I was trying to get through with scouting. I literally referred to it as the gauntlet. The messaging he wants out there is that Boy Scouts is like any other organization in America, and that these guys could come from anywhere and there's nothing we can do to prevent them. All of that is not true. Boy Scouts is exceptional in the opportunities that it presents to perpetrators to access children in no to very low supervised situations. Name another youth servant organization that has overnight access to kids over multiple days. Name another organization that a scoutmaster has the power over whether or not this youth can become an Eagle Scout. Now you back up a little bit and you think to yourself, how easy is it to get into scouting? And so now you start to see where those weaknesses are. It's removing those risk areas, known risk areas, that helps you create this safer environment for kids to participate in scouting programs. You talk to a lot of these young men, they'll tell you, my parents dropped me off at his house. We've had cases where the adult stayed the night at the kid's house.
A case file dates back to 1978. The dots on the map fade, leaving one in New Orleans, Louisiana.
Troop 137 in New Orleans was a nightmare for the Boy Scouts in a very special way. It was one of the few cases where you could say a troop had actually become a sex ring. Several men became leaders of a troop in New Orleans, specifically to get access to boys to molest. They literally recruited boys into this troop, and they had sex parties at their houses. They took pictures of the boys naked. They traded pictures with other pedophiles around the country.
Richard Windman.
I grew up in New Orleans back in the 70s. My parents separated very early, so my brother and I lived with my mom. Two men, they approached my mom. They told her that they were in the neighborhood looking for new scouts for their new troop. They agreed to pay for everything because you're a single mom. So don't worry about the cost or anything. Boy Scouts of America should never let a bunch of single men start a troop. There were four primary leaders, Tom Woodall, Louis Seow, Richard Halverson, and Harry Kramer.
The troop leaders' registration forms.
They take you out to eat. They bring you to the trampoline park to help mom out. Sea monkeys. My mom wouldn't buy me any for Christmas. And so Harry Kramer said, you know, you can have sea monkeys, but they have to be at my house. You can't tell mom. None of the scout masters had children of their own. And, you know, I'm not old enough to be a Boy Scout. There was a lot of red flags that should have been caught. The boys came from single parent homes. They were all poor. There was never a merit badge work to do. You know, we did camp outs, but that was just, you know, a convenient thing to do where you can rape a kid. So it appeared on the outside like we were actually a real troop, but we weren't. Men would fly from out of town, from all over, mostly Western Europe, but all over the United States as well. And we were raped by them as well. We were sold to them. You know, rented out, whatever you want to call it. And they always took pictures and videos of us all the time. They would bring you to hotels, primarily in the French Quarter. In fact, my mom dropped me off at the hotels a couple of times.
What did she think was happening?
Just visiting a scoutmaster from out of town. Especially when it's done to you by authority figures. You don't trust anybody.
Several photos of Richard as a boy looking absent or haunted.
You're hurting. You don't want to go to school the next day. You cry when nobody can see you. My mom, she brought me to the doctor. He was an older gentleman, always had a cigarette in his mouth. And I don't know why, but I trusted the doctor. You know, he pulled up his chair and he said, "What's going on?" I told him about the rape. No. He said, "Who's raping you?" I said, "A lot of people are raping me in the Boy Scouts." And he was like, "Get me their information, and I'll take care of it. Nobody will know it's you."
Police nabbed three in Scout sex ring.
They raided the houses, got the kiddie porn, arrested them. So he hits the nightly news.
Aggressive, cruel, crass nature of these violations is such that these little minds are going to be affected for a long, long time.
When I got older, I was one of the first people to get a copy of the perversion files. It was leaked to me. And just reading through all of it and what they knew was going on at the time and they did nothing about it, it makes you angry.
Richard works at an array of monitors hooked up to his computer, typing rapidly.
Did you ever get any kind of apology or attempt to make amends from the Boy Scouts?
Never.
Nothing?
Never.
He looks disgusted.
How do you feel about that?
Pissed off. Angry. Angry. Very angry.
Ex-BSA General Counsel Stephen McGowan.
What failures do you think that the Boy Scouts of America made that could have contributed to the scope of that problem?
I think it's bigger than the Boy Scouts of America. Remember, the Boy Scouts of America did not abuse these kids. We had some bad people that cut in. We read
people
about
under the banner of the Boy Scouts, or well, were we have or volunteers of the Boy Scouts, or scout masters, or
sure.
People that were largely involved with the program. That's what sure. This number represents.
Well, there are people. Just like school teachers and everybody else, there are bad people. There's no way to profile them ahead of time and to identify people ahead of time. All you can do is use a program like we do, which is to keep kids as safe as we can and to continually improve that. and to try to continually to improve our efforts. But nobody has a profile of a would-be abuser that you can apply as a litmus test to keep someone out.
The confidential files do show you the risky situations for the scouts. What situations are likely or more likely to expose your boys to somebody who wants to molest them, regardless of who that person is? I went down to Texas to talk to the Boy Scouts down at headquarters. I'm interviewing the guy whose name and stamp is on the front page of just about every confidential file. His signature is right next to where they describe the incident in a couple of lines. Joe Anglum says to me he's never read a confidential file.
Never read it?
Never read it. I said, I've got hundreds of files with your name on it. He said, yeah, but I don't read them. I said, did you ever count your files or analyze them to learn about sex abuse and scouting? He says, no. And I said, why not? And he said, because nobody's told us we have a problem and that we have to do that. I said, well, how would you know you have a problem unless you read the files? And he said, because we know we don't have a problem because we have a great program and we don't have any reason to believe we have a problem. So we didn't look at the files and study them because nobody said we should. And we didn't ask anybody to look at them because we didn't think we had a problem.
That's the response.
That was the response.
According to a BSA document, all volunteers must complete a rigorous application and screening process before joining.
One of the things that they had in their marketing messaging that used to drive me nuts is the Boy Scouts has a rigorous application and screening process. I was like, that's bullshit. And it's not true. It has never been true. I said, why don't we at least use a government ID? You have to use it to buy groceries, right? Show your ID. You have to use it to get on an airplane, show your ID. Why don't we at least check a government-based ID, driver's license or passport or state identification card to see, make sure, and they refuse to do that.
They refuse to do that?
Inconvenience and cost.
They didn't want to check a government ID on scoutmasters or volunteers.
They didn't want to check government ID on scoutmasters or volunteers interacting with your children.
Because it was inconvenient.
And cost.
And whatever cost it would take for that person's time to check the ID.
Yes.
Whether the information is to identify fugitives or criminal history records.
The Boy Scouts stood out in their opposition to the Child Protection Act. Most of the big youth organizations supported it. And it reflected the Boy Scouts' fear of two things, one of which was spending more money, because they had a lot of volunteers. And two, they didn't want to spend the money on the fingerprint checks. But also, the Scouts really kept resisting putting added requirements on the local organizations in order to weed out child molesters, because they felt that there was only so much they could do. And because they always were in dire need of volunteers, they didn't want to scare away volunteers.
I'll never forget it. A chief scout executive I was working under at the time literally caught me in the hallway. They said, well, Mike, you know, we were told by our lawyers and our risk management people or whomever that don't contact the parents if there's an allegation of child sexual abuse. I said, sir, well, I guess you need to make a decision. You can listen to them or you can listen to me. And I'll tell you this, I know what the hell I'm talking about. One of the many big arguments I had with general counsel is I insisted on anybody that's placed on the IV file, perversion file, or volunteer screening database, whatever it's called, for anything that has to do with sexual abuse of a child, allegation, grooming, whatever, needs to be reported to law enforcement. Well, he comes into my office, he's very upset. The law doesn't mandate that we report all these allegations of abuse unless there's reasonable suspicion that there's sexual abuse.
We have found lots of examples where in these files, time and again, the scoutmasters are told not to tell parents or not to tell law enforcement about the abuse. And we have a lot of firsthand experience about the people telling us this too.
When mistakes were made, mistakes were made. And if people did that, they were wrong. And we failed. And I know we're doing better, and I hope we'll continue to do better. But the fact is, people sometimes have made mistakes.
Just to be clear, that's wrong. If kids were repeatedly told not to tell authorities or told don't tell your parents. That's
absolutely wrong.
That is wrong.
We train kids to do just the other and have for the last 20 years or more.
Be clear what you train kids to do.
Resist, report, know what the barriers to abuse are, and to make sure that those barriers to abuse are respected by the adult leaders they work with.
And report means go straight to law enforcement.
Well, for a scout, it means go to a trusted adult. could be a parent, could be a leader, but they're trained to go to someone they're comfortable enough with to tell the information to. And from there, the trusted adult is responsible for making the communication both to law enforcement and to the BSA.
The perpetrator who's sexually abusing the youth or sexually harassing them or bothering them is typically what was formerly a trusted adult. My recommendation was to create a hotline that kids could call on their own. There's been some wonderful research that kids of today especially really use a text and chat feature for anonymous reporting. Because the fact is, while some kids will tell their parents, some kids will tell what they identify as a trusted adult, most kids want to kind of figure things out for themselves. You know, they got these computers in their hands now, especially the older teens. But when I took that proposal to Steve McGowan and the then Vice President, John Mosby, it was like, not no, but hell no. We just want kids reporting to their trusted adults, the Scoutmasters.
The Boy Scouts over the years have had what they call their youth protection policies. They have evolved over time. One of the cornerstones of their youth protection is too deep leadership. No scout is ever going to be alone with another person. And there's been a number of other changes that have happened over time, but it obviously hasn't worked.
When they developed their protection training materials, their education materials for the kids, they developed some really nice programs, videotapes for the leaders and for the kids about sex abuse. For a long time, they didn't require kids or leaders to go through that training. I said, why don't you require it? And they said, well, it's just more work for them to do, but we're going to make it available. What's interesting about this is that they would tell parents, they would tell the media, well, we developed this great child protection program that goes out to the kids and the leaders. And people assume that means everybody goes through it, but it wasn't true.
One of the things I used to get from our old general counsel was, well, we have to be careful of defaming anybody's character. And I said, well, has the organization ever been sued for making a report of child sexual abuse? Guess what? Zero. We've never been sued. And on top of that, I think we'd be in a better position if we did report. I'd rather defend ourselves for trying to protect kids than have it not reported and have to explain why we never told anybody. What better way to protect the community than to make sure to report it to law enforcement? I am hardwired to protect my community. That's what I did in law enforcement. That whole protect and serve thing, I hope you can tell where I'm going to stand on that issue. We're talking kids. We're talking people's children. Okay?
Archive footage of priests of various denominations with Boy Scouts.
The early Scout movement was built largely on religion. It is almost a religious movement, even though it's technically secular. The Boy Scout program was set up in a way that was perfect for religions to adopt it as their youth program. And in fact, religions became the foundation of scouting. You could be a Mormon, a Catholic, you could be Jewish, you could be Islamic faith. When you're reading the confidential files, when you've read a few hundred of them, it becomes a little bit hard to be shocked anymore. One of the cases that really shocked me was the case of Christopher Schultz.
Emerson, New Jersey, 1978. Headline, Scoutmaster in suit over sexual assault.
Christopher went to a local Catholic school where Brother Edmund, who was a Catholic brother, was a teacher.
A photo of Brother Edmund Coakley.
Brother Edmund was also the head of the local scout troop, which Christopher belonged to. So he was the scoutmaster and he was the teacher.
A photo of Christopher Schultz's brother, Richard, also a scout.
It's like this bad intersection of crossroads is what we got sucked into. And he was good at being able to pick out his prey and isolate and do whatever he was looking to do. I was a target, but to be used as leverage for the real target, which was my brother. And my brother was his preferred victim.
He'd been to their house. They trusted him. So they go up to this camp. Over the weekend, Brother Edmund commits some pretty serious sadomasochistic sex acts on Christopher.
A photo of Christopher with an insect.
He started to break down and have panic attacks, and he started going through bouts of hallucinations, auditory and visual, for the rest of that year. We could see and hear Brother Edmund reminding him not to tell anybody, you know, otherwise he was going to kill him.
On a bright, cold morning, Richard goes for a walk in his old neighborhood.
This is the first time I've gotten out of the car and walked this area, and it's hard. It's a time that I wish I could forget and erase. And it reminds me of a period of my life that I lost.
An old photo of one brother grinning goofily and the other scowling.
It's one of the last pictures of my brother and I. That would have been probably May of 78, I think I was saying. So I was in eighth grade, so it would be like our eighth grade graduation.
Richard picks up a school photo of Christopher, smoothing out creases with his thumb.
Even though it's the smallest, probably the last formal picture of my brother.
Middle-aged with a beard and glasses, Richard studies the photo.
I was supposed to look after my little brother. I was supposed to protect him.
A headline of Christopher's suicide.
Christopher Schultz epitomized the worst thing that could happen to a family in an abuse case. Not only was your son abused, but he was so emotionally distraught that he took his own life. Brother Edmund was kicked out of the church and fled the state. What happened to the Schultzes was they were also ostracized by part of their community, by people from the church. In several of the cases in scouting, people say that people in the scouting community called them or saw them at meetings and said, "How dare you? How dare you accuse the scouts of this? You're trying to ruin this organization."
Richard talks about the family's treatment by the Church of the Assumption.
We were 100% shunned. I remember one of the parish priests coming to the house when my father was at work, sitting down and talking to my mother, trying to leverage and pressure her to drop all this stuff. And if we didn't drop it, you're going to be run out of town. And it's nothing I can do about it. I'm trying to help you. All you have to do is stop what you're doing. If you don't, all this bad stuff is going to happen to you and your family. Do you really want that to happen, Mrs. Schultz? The length that certain people were going to try and get you to shut up and get this to go away, to protect the church. To me, the hypocrisy of both organizations through it got me the angriest.
A headline, Newark Archdiocese is freed of liability in boy's suicide.
I hold them accountable. There's blood on their hands.
Footage of the Washington National Cathedral, journalist Patrick Boyle.
Religious leaders were on the board of directors of the Boy Scouts. If you think of the Boy Scouts as a corporation, these church leaders that are on the board of directors are essentially their investors.
A headline, Mormons will join Boy Scout movement.
All the boys in the Mormon church, I'm not talking about just in one state, nationally in the United States, go through scouting. That is their youth ministry. Whereas the other churches, it was dependent on the Catholic Church, the diocese, if they had a scouting program, or the Methodists, or Episcopalians, or what have you. But for the Mormons, all boys went through it. So that is a significant membership, as well as volunteer, as well as money contribution and resource issue.
Dr. John Conte.
Scouts are an independent organization, but felt that they had to honor the biases or perspectives of their sponsors. And the Catholic Church and the Mormon Church is historically homophobic.
In 1978, they officially put in their ban on homosexuals. That was the first time the Boy Scouts stepped in and put on a requirement like that. The thought was it would end all these pedophile cases that were springing up.
Outside people will say who the perpetrator is, oh, it's a gay problem. Right? Gays are pedophiles. There's research that most perpetrators are straight men. I also think homophobia plays a really big role in why a lot of men can't come forward. It plays into their shame and pain and struggle.
Drew Tessier.
My abuse took place when I was 12. I came forward when I was 13. Growing up in the 90s, as an abuse victim, as a closeted homosexual, when the organization was still very outwardly homophobic. This is the worst thing that you could be as a man. When I told a teacher about what happened, I was immediately told, "You've done the right thing. This is a good thing." Now, this hasn't made you question your sexuality, has it? Because, you know, being gay is a terrible sin. The initial letter that my abuser, Dr. Crosley, wrote me was, "Yes, I'm sorry, but this doesn't make you gay and this doesn't make me gay." I think it takes years to shed the shame that is, you know, sort of heaped on you directly or indirectly your entire life. I don't think there was a separation in people's minds between pedophilia and homosexuality.
One of the first national meetings I went to, I was walking with one of the assistant chief scout execs, and he made the comment that homosexuals are pedophiles, and that's our primary problem in Boy Scouts with youth protection. And I said, no, yeah. And I'm like, he goes, yeah, Mike, you need to understand that homosexuals are pedophiles. I'm like, no, they're not. And he's like, Mike, no, yes, they are. Now, understand, this is a VP level, assistant chief scout executive, saying this to me. I'm like, no, they're not. And I said, who do you think, I mean, you realize that's my whole world, okay, is interviewing victims and interrogating perpetrators. If they were, I would tell you, all right? But that's not the issue.
But here's someone at the top level conflating homosexuality and pedophilia.
Not only at the very top level, he wasn't the only one. This was a reoccurring theme.
An old scouting pamphlet calls on scouts to be morally straight.
More than one person has told us that inside the organization, even the very top levels, homosexuality was equated with pedophilia. Was that belief common among leadership in the scouts, that there was a connection here?
I can't speak to what they thought, but I think...
Well, you can speak to what the tone is inside the leadership and what was being said. You were there at that time.
No, I never experienced that in my time. I experienced it in my life for many years as I grew up in society and communities and churches and things like that, that there were a number of common misperceptions, but I never experienced that while I was in scouting.
Do you believe there's a link between...
No.
Did the focus for so long on gay scout leaders lead the organization down the wrong path? In other words, away from solving the problems of abuse with boys?
I can't answer that. I don't know.
Is it a distraction for the real problem?
No, I don't think so.
Is it a... You don't think it was a distraction?
No.
Michael Johnson.
I remember thinking, this organization is focused more on getting gays out than protecting kids from child molesters. They think getting gays out is protecting kids from child molesters, and they're like going down a completely wrong path. Then I learned about the Dale decision.
The U.S. Supreme Court heard arguments today over banning gays from being Boy Scout leaders. The issue is a New Jersey court's ruling that it violates a state anti-discrimination law.
Is not being a homosexual a core issue to being a scout?
The message of the Boy Scouts is what kind of behavior boys should engage in, and that's morally straight and clean behavior.
Why did the Boy Scouts defend this so rigorously in the Dale decision that went all the way to the Supreme Court?
Well, again, I wasn't there.
I know, but you were a lawyer and general counsel.
I can't tell you what happened in 1990. 2000, whichever year that decision was.
You have no thoughts on why they went to the Supreme Court to defend the right to discriminate against gay scout leaders?
Well, I think that it reflected the values of the organization at the time, which have changed, as have society's values. Homosexuality was considered by the organization to be inconsistent with the values of scouting. We have adapted and we have embraced diversity. We have brought girls into the program. We have evolved and will continue to evolve. And in some ways, we're right alongside. In some ways, we may be a little behind. In some ways, we may be a little bit forward. It's a private organization. Until the constituents of that organization are ready for that change, then it's very difficult to try to implement those kind of changes. The people need to be brought along. They need time. They need to be able to adjust to it. It's like any other changes that we have.
Footage of scout leaders at anti-gay protests.
I'm the new youth protection director. As I was starting to wanting to do some, what I thought were very medium level policies and content training upgrades for youth protection, I kept getting told that the Mormons may not like that. The Mormons don't like that. And I told them, I said, I came to work for the Boy Scouts of America. I came here to protect the kids, the boys and girls of the Boy Scouts of America. I am not working for the Mormon Church and the Catholic Church. And I remember, I'll never forget this, Jim Terry, the same assistant chief scout executive, told me, Mike, you need to understand something. I'm like, what is that, sir? He says, the Mormons are sacrosanct.
Stephen McGowan over imagery of a Mormon church.
At the time of the change, there was no pressure being exerted on us at all. And
by the Mormons?
No.
No pressure at all from the Mormons to keep the gay ban in place?
No.
Was that a concern about?
Was it a concern? Well, sure, it was a concern. I mean, you know, we're concerned about all of our constituents. We're concerned about our stakeholders and the organization continuing to be able to maintain that relationship. But there was no threats. There was no gnashing of teeth.
Captions: On July 27th, 2015, 15 years after the Dale decision, the Boy Scouts lifted the ban on gay scout leaders. On December 31st, 2019, the Church of Latter-day Saints left the Boy Scouts and is no longer affiliated with the organization. Journalist Patrick Boyle over footage of a white stone courthouse.
Legally, the Scouts continually succeeded for decades by basically hiding the abuse as best they could, not even looking at their own cases and playing hardball in court. When they did go to court against the family, they would ask the kid, you know, did you enjoy the sex with the adult? They would tell the juries this kid was damaged goods by the time he came to us because the kid had been emotionally troubled.
Damaged goods.
Damaged goods. They would, because one of the ironies of this is that abuse experts will tell you that kids who are troubled in some way, emotionally troubled, are particularly vulnerable to the attention of an adult who is grooming them and then, among other things, starts luring them into sexual activity. Lawyers would call me. Can I come see your files? Lawyers had always been very generous to me. I consider these public records. So I said, sure, come on by my house. One of the attorneys who came to get the files was Tim Kosnoff.
I tracked Boyle down, and he was living in D.C. I said, what I'm going to do is I'm going to hire a high-speed scanning service to come and set two scanners up in that bedroom, and they're going to scan all those files. There were about 150,000 pages. We litigated that up to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court said the Boy Scouts had to produce an additional 3,200 files.
Kosnoff types on a laptop.
You'd read about the Boy Scouts going to trial somewhere. They usually got the snot kicked out of them.
A 2010 case.
One huge blunder came in Portland. That was a case involving the Mormon Church. The Mormons wisely settled that case. But the Boy Scouts threw the dice in Oregon, which was the worst place in the world for them to roll the dice because Oregon has punitive damages.
The Portland lawsuit brought by Carrie Lewis was a watershed moment, and it was really a big explosion in the face of the Boy Scouts.
Carrie was molested by Timmer Dykes.
Paul Mones, attorney for Carrie Lewis.
Timmer Dykes was a scout leader in a Mormon-sponsored troop. There was a warning about him to the local bishop. The bishop still allowed him to stay in the troop, and he molested at some point, I believe, 15 to 17 of the 31 kids in the troop. We wanted to put for the jury that Carrie Lewis was a victim of not just Timmer Dykes, but of the Boy Scouts of America.
A BSA letter refers to their confidential records on Timmer Dykes.
We wanted the jury to have a granular understanding of what the Boy Scouts knew historically about the problem of sexual abuse.
The jury came back and awarded the plaintiff in that case $18 million. That, of course, made a lot of headlines. And then those lawyers got the court to order that these perversion files, that they come into the public record as evidence in that trial. And therefore, the public had a right of access to them.
Kelly Clark, attorney for Carrie Lewis.
We are today releasing, pursuant to court order, about 1,200 files kept by the Boy Scouts of America historically from 1965 to 1985 that the Boy Scouts of America has historically referred to as the perversion files.
Carrie Lewis became the voice of a lot of voiceless people.
The significance to the public is the same significance as it was at trial to the jury, which is that they represent a body of knowledge that the Boy Scouts of America had that no other youth organization had at that time or since.
I just don't believe the Boy Scouts really understood the gravity of what it was. The femoral artery was cut and they were slowly bleeding out, but they didn't really see it that way. the Boy Scouts that knew this stuff was going on and just swept it under the rug or didn't call the cops or didn't call social services and let the lives of these boys just be torn asunder.
The Boy Scouts have resisted legal efforts to make more of the files public. Now, however, details have been put online listing the names of some 1,900 Scout leaders suspected or convicted of abusing children. Victims' rights attorney Tim Kosnoff posted the list.
The cat was pretty much out of the bag involving the Boy Scouts of America. They have abused their privilege and their position since the beginning because they never told people about the nature and extent of the problem. They never told parents. They never warned Scouts. So they became an organization which was lying to the American people, to parents, and to Congress in their annual reports about the actual risks of scouting.
Journalist Patrick Boyle.
It's frankly hard for me to understand, even to this day, how you could have all those files about sex abuse in your organization and not think you had a problem. And let's just give the best intentions. The guys running the Boy Scouts had a very good program. They believed in their program, and they didn't want to put the program at risk by scaring people unnecessarily about a small problem. The question is, when do you decide that a small problem isn't a small problem?
It's a lot like the Catholic Church with its secret archives. Adults are keeping track of their potential liabilities. They see that this is potentially problematic for them and their reputation. The Boy Scouts represents itself as a place of honor. And so these files are the evidence that could hurt their reputation as being honorable. So the instinctual move was to just make sure they buried it, because the institution is more important than the individual.
That was Marcy Hamilton of Child USA.
The only defenses that the Boy Scouts and their insurance companies have had in all these years is the statute of limitations, where these regressive, predator-friendly laws have closed the courthouse doors to victims at age 21.
A statute of limitations is just a deadline. It's the arbitrary deadline set for when you file a lawsuit or you prosecute. We don't have a statute of limitations for murder. We tend to have shorter statutes of limitations for contract disputes. Child sex abuse in this universe is a lot more like murder than it is like a contract, because the victim didn't understand what happened to them. Child sex abuse festers and lives on in the soul of the child for decades. It's not a broken leg. The more I worked on statute of limitations, the more I saw that we were just suppressing the victims across the United States, silencing them, and empowering the organizations. When I started looking at this in the midst of the Catholic sex abuse scandal, I started to ask, what would happen if you just said, forget the statute of limitations. Let's just get rid of it. So I started working on those issues. Right now, we're in the midst of this vibrant social movement in which survivors are coming forward and demanding justice. And they changed the world with their stories, no question about it. And lawmakers, even those who love the Boy Scouts or love the churches, or love the boarding schools, those people are actually paying attention and siding with the children. And so now a third of the states have completely opened the statute of limitations at some point.
Michael Pfau, attorney.
When the statute of limitations changed in New York, New Jersey, and California, three very, very populous states with lots of people, lots of children, and lots of scouts, the Boy Scouts faced exposure that they'd never faced before.
Christopher Hurley, BSA Survivors Attorney.
The Boy Scouts concluded that they were going to get inundated with claims, which they were, and they felt that the easiest way for them to manage that would be bankruptcy.
Headlines on the BSA filing for bankruptcy in the face of abuse lawsuits.
The clock is ticking for survivors of abuse by Boy Scout leaders. Monday is the deadline to file a proof of claim before potentially losing that chance forever.
When the bankruptcy occurred and claims started to get filed, I was asked for a prediction, and I said, whew, I'm going to say on the high end, maybe 10,000 people are going to come forth.
Jason Fiamala, BSA Survivors Attorney.
You start to see the numbers come in, and we're passing 20,000, we're passing 30,000, we're passing 40,000, passing 50,000, and it's like, oh my God.
We knew it was going to be a big number, but I'll have to say I was amazed at how big that number got.
The accusations exceed 82,000.
A staggering 82,000 alleged victims have made sexual abuse claims against the Boy Scouts of America.
We've gone from 231 files about abusers, didn't know how many victims then, to 82,000 victims, which is just mind-blowing.
Survivor Doug Kennedy on a laptop.
I think at the heart of the experience for a lot of survivors is that notion of not being in control. I wasn't in control when I was abused. My abuser controlled that situation leading up to it and during and after. So anytime I can take back a little bit of control for what happened to me, it's very, very powerful.
At his home, Army veteran and former Boy Scout Michael Nussbaum and his fiancée Andrea Phipps flick through old photo albums, arranging pictures of himself as a child.
I'm not out to be a millionaire. I'm not out to get a bunch of money. I have a great retirement from the military. I don't need that. What I'm hoping to get out is that no child will ever be hurt again the way I was. That has always been my goal. That has always been my number one thing, was that the Boy Scouts not only are responsible, take responsibility for what happened, but they have a new campaign and a new challenge, and that's to make sure this never happens again.
Tom Crummins.
There isn't a single survivor that's in this for the money. That is not the driving force for any of us. We want to feel like our voices are heard. We want to feel like there's an opportunity to heal.
I'm speaking on behalf of no other survivor or no other group, but I will tell you unequivocally, I want to speak for the dead. I want to speak for those kids who did not survive, those kids who were lost to suicide, alcohol, addiction, mutilation, self-mutilation, self-harm. I'm here to speak for my friend Patrick, who I miss to this day.
Former Boy Scout John Sakowitz nods to himself, bereft. Attorney Tim Kosnoff speaks at a press conference.
The time has come for a full accounting of what has gone on in this organization, which in my opinion is nothing less than an atrocity, and it has to stop.
Negotiations and bankruptcy are often heated. This particular case has been unusually and extremely difficult.
Douglas Baird.
The Boy Scouts case may be one of the most complicated and structurally difficult bankruptcies ever. In the simplest bankruptcy case, typically the debtor will have assets. If it's a business, then that business will have assets. It'll have airplanes. It'll have machinery. If you think of a typical corporation, figuring out its assets is just not that hard. At some fundamental level, you can just sell the assets, turn it into cash. It becomes much, much harder when what you have is not one neat pile of assets, but many related organizations, all of whom may or may not be legally responsible. If, for example, you're victimized and you were in South Dakota, not clear you should have any claim to assets that are owned by a local organization in New York, and vice versa. It's not clear that you might all have rights against the national organization, but how many assets does the national organization actually have? But simply pulling together the assets in this case is enormously complicated. Ultimately, we really should care about the victims and whether they're actually getting their rights vindicated. And in this complicated a process with this many moving pieces, it's hard to say that that's actually happening.
No one was thinking about child sex abuse when Chapter 11 was put into place. So now you get a bad actor is the debtor, and the whole legal scaffolding that is now around the debtor is all about protecting the debtor. All of a sudden, sex abuse victims in the thousands are now creditors. They are legally equivalent to the roofer that wasn't paid yet. And they're told they're now a herd and they're not going to have individual lawsuits. We've drafted legislation to amend the bankruptcy code because of that. I mean, it simply was never intended to be a warehouse for sex abuse survivors.
A legal ad for seeking compensation.
You worry that a lawyer will settle on the cheap. Why litigate a case in full if with a 1 minute phone call, I can get half that amount? It's not great for the victim, but it's very good for the lawyer because they're still getting 30% of 50% for doing almost no work. That's what you need to worry about, the ways in which the lawyer's incentives are going to depart from the incentives of the victim.
Chapter 11 bankruptcy is not the place for child abuse.
The legal proceeding that turns the victims into collateral damage, just like they were as a kid, and then you reach the settlement, you know, the end of the bankruptcy, and what is the glory of that? The offending institution gets to live on. And they get to say, if you didn't come forward during the bankruptcy, you don't have a claim. Bankruptcy is constructed for the powerful, and the powerful win.
Ex-BSA General Counsel Stephen McGowan gives an interview.
The Boy Scouts argued for a very long time that sexual abuse was a minuscule problem. This was a minuscule problem. This was a small thing. Given the existence of the files, everything that we know now, 82,000 people coming forward, this is a lot of real individuals in pain. That was a lie. That was a cover-up, right? The Boy Scouts lied about that being a problem.
Oh, yeah. 82,000 over what period of time? And we don't even know that that's the number. But one is too many.
But why
One was too many. We're a microcosm of the society that we're in. 95% of abuse happens in the home or with someone within the family. What have you read lately in the news about kids that are being sexually abused? It's happening in the schools, and it's happening in other places. We believe one of the best ways we can do it, in addition to all the things we're doing, is to set up a basis by which you can track these people and keep them from getting into organizations. Because that's what we know they do, is they seek access to youth. Until we can prevent them from getting access to youth, we will never be as far along the road in protecting these kids, and that to us is the most important thing. Is it absolutely perfectly safe, and you can guarantee no one will ever have an accident, no one will ever have an undesirable person doing something or trying to do something with them? No, but you create as many safeguards as you can. There's no perfect plan, and there's no endless stream of money. And no amount of money is going to compensate any of these survivors, any of these victims, for what happened to them. No amount of apologies is ever going to erase. And that's not what we're trying to do. We're bringing them into our governance. We're bringing them into our youth protection. We're asking survivors that are willing to come out and come forward and to monitor what we're doing, because we are committed to this. But nobody is more sorry. And nobody thinks that the compensation that these survivors will get will ever be enough.
Kind of the way I see it is that trust is key to the Scouts. I mean, I don't want to put my kids in the Scouts unless I trust them.
And so, go ask the leaders.
I'm asking you.
I would go visit units. I would go look at the units.
Why should Americans trust the Scouts? Why should we look at this and say, they've got it?
Look at what we're doing to keep kids safe. Look at the protections that we're offering, and then make up your own mind.
A U.S. flag alongside Boy Scout flags outside the BSA National Capital Area Council Building. Michael Johnson.
The whole 95% thing. He talks about things like he's an expert on this, which he's not even factually accurate or correct. He's deflecting to general society and schools and all that and not focusing on, I mean, listen. The Boy Scouts of America is coming out of a 82,000 plus and counting boys to men survivors of sexual abuse. And he's deflecting to talk about other entities? Boy Scouts wants society to think that sexual abuse in the Boy Scouts of America is all in the past. Look at the numbers, because they're a lot more 40, 30, 20 years ago. But what they're not telling you is it takes a man, not as a boy, a man, at least 20 years. And again, if they tell anybody about it, most men only tell somebody who's like their wife or a therapist or somebody that's trusted to them, but most of them never tell anybody that can do anything about it and stop it. Now, I want you to think about that for boys that are currently in scouting right now. Keep in mind, there's been no congressional statewide investigation into what happened.
Doug Kennedy over shots of the White House.
The only way this isn't going to continue to happen is if someone steps forward and says, we need to investigate this. Whether it's a congressperson, senator, president, that's willing to have the courage to say, Department of Justice, some other entity, let's figure out what happened here. Because by understanding it, we can prevent it. And I use the word courage very, very specifically because part of the Boy Scouts charter that's authorized by Congress lays out they're responsible for teaching patriotism and courage. So that's what we need on the behalf of our elected leaders right now, to step in and say, what happened? Let's get an idea of what we can do to solve this.
Waves ripple on the surface of a water feature dedicated to the Boy Scouts of America. Michael Johnson walks past the Washington Monument.
You came forward in a pretty spectacular way and spoke out against the Boy Scouts. Why'd you want to come forward?
To me, being silent, knowing what I know, is being complicit. You talk to people who know me, they know I don't yield, I don't quit. And I was working up to the day I left to keep Scouts safe, even though I knew that it was like four steps forward, two steps back. Part of my employment contract had a part in there that, to get my severance, that I had to sign a form, a waiver with them. And they said, no, you can't talk to anybody about anything that has anything to do with the Boy Scouts of America. I don't do excuses. Either you do it or you don't. That's how my daddy raised me, you know? Either you do it or you don't. I went into Boy Scouts of America to do a job. I went in there to help the organization do a better job of keeping kids safe. I had some successes even to going up against the crap I was having to deal with, but ultimately I failed. I'm here to tell you that the organization is still not safe for boys and girls. I have investigated and protected children my whole life. I'm not gonna sit here and be quiet while I know kids are still at risk of being sexually abused in scouting. So if I am not saying anything, I am complicit. That's not gonna happen. I can't be complicit. I said, I'll walk away from it.
The headline reiterates Michael's position.
One of my epiphanies in life is I get to choose who defines me. That's a big deal.
Today, I will be introducing first Michael Johnson.
This call to action is not meant to end scouting. Anybody who knows me, you scouters that are out there, if you know me, you know that's not what this is about. We must instead create the independent accountability and oversight that is necessary for a safer scouting program right now. The organization as it now stands fails to meet this ideal. It fails our nation, it fails our families, it fails every scout in the program. My good friend is a national survivor. He's talked about his story. He said, Michael, let me explain something to you. He said, you show me a man that's been sexually abused, I'll show you a lot of shame. I think about that. Shame is a big word for a man. I told him, and I said, you know what? I don't like the idea of these men carrying any shame. If anybody ought to be carrying shame, it's the Boy Scouts of America.
To you survivors, and I feel strongly about speaking directly to you, I've had the opportunity to meet numerous of you over the years while I was at Boy Scouts and since I've left.
He tears up at a press conference.
And then the scouts that left scouting because they didn't want to put up with their sexual abuse, continued sexual abuse. So this is for each and every single one of you, because I never forgot you while I was there, and I will never forget you and your experiences.
The survivors have been very kind. You know, the guys,
Pausing with a pained smile, he dabs at his eyes with a handkerchief.
These men have validated what I did. They're courageous. They're the ones that are heroic.
Survivor Christopher Haywood walks through Chicago.
What made me want to say something? I got tired. It was either now or never. I can remember on a night, my mother was standing on 73rd and Coles. And Carl lived 72nd and South Shore Drive, which is right around the corner. I just built up the courage in me, and something in me said, leave. He was there at the house. I ran out, and it's a high-rise building. I didn't even take the elevator. I ran down the stairs, left everything, just whatever I had on is what went with me. And, you know, I ran in with this look on my face and the feeling over me. So I get to my mother's house, and she's just keeps saying, what happened? It just was building, it was building, and my blood was boiling. The following day, I wind up telling her. It felt like a lot of stuff was released. I knew it was over after me leaving there that night, that it was done. I felt like now I can better share my story. I felt justice could come our way.
Survivor Doug Kennedy throws a toy for his dog on the beach.
I kept this bottled up until I was about 50 and was going through some struggles, midlife crisis, I guess. My wife and I, we had grown apart a little bit. And she knew there was something else going on. She knew that there was something I wasn't telling her. And I told her. Her initial reaction, I was so proud, was she was so angry. She was so angry at what happened to me. And she said, you know, goddamn scouts. My mother, the number of times I wanted to tell her, I just need to let you know something that happened to me. And the reason why I became so distant at the end of high school and in college, I mean, we never talked in college. She eventually ended up getting lung cancer. And the doctor called me in and then said, either you or me has to tell your mother she has inoperable lung cancer. She ended up living 3 months. We shared a lot over those 3 months. But I never told her. I never told her.
When did you first tell somebody? When did you first come forward and talk about it?
Maybe like 15 years ago or something like that. Like when I was an adult already. I never even considered telling anybody. I mean, maybe it's just because so many people did come forward or whatever. For the most part, this right now is the first time most people are going to find out, you know? I'm embarrassed of this shit. I really am. It embarrasses me. It's like, it sucks, man. It just sucks. Makes me so, I have such anger problems. I just get so mad. I feel like I just got cheated out of so much shit in my life because of this shit, like for real, just cheated out of it.
Survivor Anthony Mandich.
It's cathartic. I mean, really, truly, I mean, it feels hurt, but it feels good too because, you know, I don't want to have this feeling forever. I don't want to have it anymore.
Michael Nussbaum looks at a photo of his family.
I wish they were alive today so that I could tell them what happened to me. You know, keeping that a secret for so long.
He and his fiancée weep silently as he studies it.
I honestly think... I think my parents would have... My father would have been receptive and understood. He probably would have been angry. Angry that I didn't tell him sooner.
Dabbing away tears, he kisses her forehead.
It's just something you keep. And I'll let you all know this. Five people in the room, you're the first five people that ever heard that.
He shrugs with a rueful smile.
Why now? Because I just feel like I unloaded a ton of rocks off my shoulders.
Footage of different survivors getting on with their lives.
To know you're not alone, though, is a different story. to know you're not in a fight alone. A fight for what? To be normal, to feel normal.
Survivor Tom Crummins takes down a large eagle statuette from a bookshelf.
This is the trophy or award my father got for being a scoutmaster. It's seen better days, but it's also the thing that gives me that connection to him more than anything else. And this is why I'm speaking up.
He looks at it solemnly.
It's what an eagle would do. I can't tell you how many times I look at this and I'll just hold it the same way and I'll cry.
His fingers play over glued together cracks on the statuette.
Some of the wings, you can look and see there's kind of a haphazard glue job on it, because at some points in the past, I've gotten so angry at what this represents that I've just chucked it at the wall and then struggled to piece it together. This bankruptcy isn't the end. This is just one step in the process.
Boy Scouts march in a parade carrying a vast, unfurled U.S. flag. Captions: the Delaware bankruptcy judge approved a settlement plan for $2.46 billion. The Boy Scouts have spent an estimated $300 million in legal fees. Attorneys and bankruptcy consultants stand to share approximately $1 billion. Survivors still don't know how much they will receive or when. The Boy Scouts of America will continue operations. If you or someone you know has experienced sexual abuse or is struggling with their mental health, information and resources are available at www.wannatalkaboutit.com. Audio description created by Ayuno, written by Edwin Wills, narrated by Diane Perry. Directed by Brian Knappenberger. Produced by Clive Patterson. Produced by Connor Fetting Smith and Sabrina Park. Co-producers Rebecca Pike and Sarah Villarreal. Executive producer Orlando von Einsiedel. Executive producer Brian Knappenberger. Co-executive producers Claire Tucker and Anna Murphy. Edited by Sean Jarrett. Director of Photography, Jay Visit. Other credits follow. Copyright 2023, Netflix. Luminant, Grain, Insight Films.
A red letter N unfolds into a spectrum of colors.